Good morning. Why don't we get started? There may be a few more people trickling in, but we might as well get moving. Welcome to our breakfast seminar regarding maintaining a union-free workplace. My name is Brad Smith from Goodwin Procter, and I'm here with my partner, Bill Benoit. We're also very pleased to welcome this morning Bill Bray from the Omni Group. Bill is one of the founding principals of the Omni Group, which provides labor and employee relations consulting strategies. Among other things, they specialize in strategic assistance in the face of union organizing campaigns. We've worked with Bill in the past and are very pleased to have Bill participating this morning. Our discussion today is going to focus on some of the issues and strategies under current law for maintaining a union-free workplace. It's also going to include an update regarding the proposed Employee Free Choice Act, as well as some of the other legislative alternatives that have been proposed. We're going to describe the existing process for a union election to the extent that an election petition is filed in the workplace, and then also describe some of the proposed changes regarding that procedure that are anticipated, both under pending legislation as well as changes that may result in a change in the makeup of the National Labor Relations Board, and that is already in the works. We're also going to talk about some of the steps and self-analysis that each of you as employers should consider doing, the knowledge you need to have to understand your level of risk regarding a successful union campaign in your place. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn to Bill Benoit. Let me remind you also that if any of you do have questions, please raise your hand during the course of the presentation. We'll do our best to answer them during the course. If not, we will have some time at the end of the presentation for questions, and we'll be around for a few minutes at the conclusion to be able to speak with you privately as well. I should tell you, too, that the written materials that you have, they do go into significantly greater depth on some of the topics than we'll be able to cover today. So they're intended to be a resource for you and to be taken away. In addition, the PowerPoint and all the written materials that you have today are available through our website on the Labor and Employment Department page of the Goodwin Procter website. So Bill's going to introduce the Employee Free Choice Act. And Bill, let me ask you, what there's been much ado about this new legislation. Does it really change the playing field for union organizing?
Well, Brad, before I start, let me say that as you all probably are aware, the chances of the Employee Free Choice Act passing in its current form are very, very slim. There just isn't enough support the way it currently looks for that act to get 60 votes that would be necessary to get by a filibuster, and given the controversial nature of the provisions, as we'll discuss in a minute, I think a filibuster would be certain. And there are a number of Democratic senators that have expressed opposition to some of the principles that underlie this, quote, Free Choice Act. Before I get started, let me just ask the audience. I know the folks from NESN have been through a campaign fairly recently. How many of you have been involved in a union organizing campaign or an LRB election campaign? Okay, so some of what we say later on may be a bit simplistic. We'll try to avoid that if we can, but on the other hand, we have to be aware that many in our audience haven't been through it and need to understand the fundamentals. Brad, to answer your question, would the Employee Free Choice Act radically or significantly change the landscape for labor relations in the United States? Absolutely. This legislation, as it's proposed, would literally turn the fundamental principles of the act that have been in effect for 70-plus years on their head. And as I think about the National Labor Relations Act, I think that there are two keystone principles. The first is that the question of union representation should be decided in a democratic fashion, in a free, thoughtful, carefully orchestrated, and supervised secret ballot election. That's a fundamental principle of democracy in this country, and the Employee Free Choice Act would eviscerate that. Secondly, the Employee Free Choice Act goes beyond the simple question of how union representation issues are decided, but it addresses collective bargaining, and it would fundamentally change the bedrock principle of collective bargaining. And that principle is that, you know, what's agreed to at the table, the collective bargaining agreement that's eventually reached, isn't something that's dictated from above, isn't something that's legislated by the government. It's the result of what the courts have characterized as the free play of economic forces. The economic climate, the economic strength of the employer, the value of the wages and benefit package, the competitive position, the overall labor market, all of those are factors that go into the strength of the parties at the table. If employees are in a position of strength, then their threat of a strike or an actual strike can be effective. On the other hand, if for various reasons, including the good benefits and competitive wages that employees already have, they don't have much leverage, if a strike really can't hurt the employer, then the employer is in a better position to sort of have its way in the negotiations, and rightfully so. Well, the Employee Free Choice Act would change all that by imposing a mandatory interest arbitration requirement. And that's a general overview. Let me talk about the specific principles and provisions of the Act. As you all probably know, and as I just said, now unions are selected based upon a secret ballot election that's supervised by the National Labor Relations Board. Unions file a petition, typically. They can be recognized voluntarily by an employer, but that rarely happens. So a petition's filed, the board runs an election, and if 50% plus one of the employees in an appropriate unit vote for the union, then the union is the representative of those employees. Prior to the election, the union has an opportunity to campaign, but not on the work premises, but off premises with employees, and explain, you know, why they should choose a union. The employer has a chance to campaign. We'll get into this in more detail later. But the fundamental fact is that the employer has a chance to express its views and explain to employees why they're better off without a union. With this new legislation, the concept of an election can be out the window. If a union under this statute, as it's proposed, were to obtain authorization cards, which ordinarily are simply enough to generate the election process, but if they present 50% plus one of the employees in an appropriate unit who have signed cards authorizing the union to represent them, then there is no election. The NLRB under the statute is required to order the employer to bargain with that union, and what can happen is this organizing activity can take place without the employer even knowing that it's going on. Yes?
Do they represent all employees in that unit, or just those that voted for the
union? Or just those who signed the cards?
Just those who signed
the cards. No, they represent all the employees in the appropriate unit. So it's it creates a situation where the employer could literally be presented with an obligation to bargain without never knowing that this was going on, without ever having a chance to tell the employees the other side of the story. And it also creates a situation where unions and pro-union employees can put a lot of pressure on their coworkers to sign cards. Employees may sign cards even though they're ambivalent about it, because they just they don't want to deal with the pressure from their coworkers. So that's a fundamental sea change. Yes?
What's the current regulation petition for an election? Is it 50%, 51%?
Well, to get an election, a union needs 30% of the employees in an appropriate unit to sign a petition or to sign cards. Another thing to remember is that under the current NLRB rules, cards that are signed are good for a year. So if some employee signs a card in May of 2009, he may very well have changed his mind over the interim, but that card still counts as a vote for the union, so to speak, under this statute. The next key provision of the statute as proposed is that once a union is represented, bargaining has to move quickly. And if a collective bargaining agreement hasn't been negotiated within 90 days, then either party can insist on mediation supervised and run by the federal government. Now, there is a mediation provision in the current statute, but the difference here is that it can be mandated, whereas under the current law, it's voluntary. Secondly, if mediation fails after 30 days, either party can insist on mandatory binding interest arbitration. And what interest arbitration is, the parties submit their positions to an arbitrator or a panel of arbitrators. It's not clear under the Act. Selected by the government. Again, the process of how arbitrators are selected is not spelled out in the statute, but the statute contemplates that the arbitrator or the panel of arbitrators would impose a contract on the parties that would be good for 2 years. Now, there are no standards in this Employee Free Choice Act as to what factors the arbitrators should consider in deciding what the contract should be. No provisions as to how the arbitrators would be selected. And, of course, what this process would do is it would really discourage collective bargaining because the unions would have no incentive at all to negotiate in good faith because in 90 days, they'd be in a position to insist on mediation and then binding arbitration. Another bedrock principle of the National Labor Relations Act is that bargaining in good faith, which is the ultimate requirement for the employer has a union representing its employees, bargaining in good faith doesn't mean that the employer has to agree to a proposal of the union. It isn't required to make any specific concessions. It just has to have an intent to reach agreement. Well, you can throw that out the window. The employer cannot engage in good faith but hard bargaining. I guess it could, but after 90 days, it has to submit to a process where a collective bargaining agreement can be forced down its throat. So that radically changes the landscape, and it would change even if there were a campaign. If for some reason a union chose to go through the representation election process rather than authorization cards, there wouldn't be much for the employer to campaign about because one of the things that employers can say that's very effective is that the unions can't really guarantee anything. Wages could go up, they could be down. No promises, no threats. Well, now, with this statute, the union could say, well, you're not going to lose anything. No arbitrator in the world is going to take something away from you. So bargaining no longer would be a two-way street. Other provisions of the Act that are significant but not as important as the ones I've mentioned. The Act increases the remedies for a violation of the statute. Currently, the only remedy is posting a notice indicating to the employees that you're not going to do whatever it is that you are accused of having done again, notifying them of their rights. And if someone has been economically damaged as a result of a violation, for example, if an employee has been discharged and the NLRB were to have found that that was because of his protected union activity, the employee would be reinstated and receive a back pay award. Under this new statute, the back pay awards would be trebled. They'd be the original back pay plus double damages. So that's treble damages in total. The Act also provides for fines of up to $20,000 for each infraction. There aren't any standards for how the board is to measure what's an appropriate fine, and it isn't clear, but it's quite possible that a single type of infraction, for example, an allegedly coercive conversation that an employer had, and remember, these conversations may be one-on-one, and it's the employee's word against the employer's word as to what was actually said in some cases. You could have a similar conversation that the employer thought was permissible regarding the consequences of unionization and pointing to, let's say, layoffs at other unionized facilities that might be misconstrued by an employee. There are ambiguities in the conversation that the employer has with several people. Well, is that one violation or is that five or six? It's not clear. By the way, there are no fines in this statute as it's proposed with respect to union unfair labor practice activity. If a union is found to have coerced an employee in signing a card or engaged in other inappropriate threatening behavior to try to get organizational rights, the statute doesn't impose any fines whatsoever. And lastly, there's a change in the law with respect to injunctive relief. If an employer is accused of having discharged an employee because of his or her sympathies for a union, and the NLRB investigates and finds reasonable cause to think that perhaps there's a violation and thus there ought to be a trial, the act, as drafted, would mandate that the NLRB go to a federal court and seek an injunction while that hearing is pending that orders the employer to put the employee back to work. So those are, I think, to answer your first question, some pretty fundamental changes in the act, Brad.
The Employee Free Choice Act has met a fair amount of opposition, particularly in the last several months, that has been publicly voiced. Most significantly was Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who at the end of March indicated that he would not support the Employee Free Choice Act in its current form. It's ironic that Senator Specter took such a public stance. You know, he was one of the original sponsors of the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, he actually repeated his opposition after he switched parties. So he's stated it both as a Republican and as a Democrat. He focused most particularly on two of the more controversial aspects of the Employee Free Choice Act that Bill focused on. First of all, he focused on the elimination of the secret ballot. According to Senator Specter, the secret ballot was, in his mind, a, quote, cornerstone of how contests are decided in a democratic society. And during the run-up to Senator Specter's announcement of opposition, there was quite a bit of focus on public publicity surrounding, for example, how unions do in fact lobby potential union members of the bargaining unit to sign cards. There was quite a bit of publicity surrounding alleged intimidation by union organizers of bargaining unit employees surrounding the collection of cards. And obviously a lot of pundits do credit much of that publicity to Senator Specter's and other legislators' public opposition to the current form of the Employee Free Choice Act. Now, Senator Specter also voiced opposition to the mandatory arbitration provision of the Employee Free Choice Act that Bill referenced, obviously resulting in a first collective bargaining agreement, despite the mutual agreement of the parties through good faith bargaining. Senator Specter did suggest several revisions to existing law that he's indicated that he would support. And those revisions include, one, an expedited timetable for an election and for the resolution of any challenges to, for example, the scope of the bargaining unit, the status of individuals as to whether or not they are properly employees or whether they should be deemed supervisors, and other such pre-election proceedings. Senator Specter proposed a 21-day, for example, time frame from the date the petition is filed to the date of the final secret ballot election for the particular unit. Secondly, Senator Specter did propose unfair labor practice charges, a new form of ULP, for an employer who denies a union access, equal access to employees, for example, if those employees are assembled for a captive audience speech as part of the union campaign. You're going to hear later on this morning about captive audience speeches, which is a term of art referencing generally an employer-arranged communication that occurs within 24 hours of the date of the election, where the employer summarizes all of the reasons why the employee should vote no. Well, there's many of the legislative alternatives to the Employee Free Choice Act have proposed equal access by the union to the employees during those types of communications. And again, the unions have been very vocal regarding the fact that they feel that that unfair access that they have at that point in the campaign unfairly tips the table on behalf of the employers during this period of campaign. In addition, Senator Spector did propose that there should be enhanced penalties, similar to the penalty provisions of the Employee Free Choice Act. In addition, Senator Spector indicated support for a short time frame, and he indicated 21 days, after a successful union election where the union is identified as the new collective bargaining representative, that there should be a contract negotiation should begin in good faith within 3 weeks following that certification. And that there should be a bargaining schedule established, you know, to the extent that it's deemed that the employer is not proceeding in good faith and engaging in bargaining. And now, in addition to Senator Spector's comments, there have been several alternative pieces of legislation that have been filed. You should know before I profile Senator Sestak's legislation, or I should say Representative Sestak's legislation, there have been some alternative pieces of legislation that are profiled in tab two of the materials that have been filed, in essence, guaranteeing the secret ballot election, you know, guaranteeing that a collective bargaining agreement can only result from mutual agreement through good faith negotiation. And some of those pieces of legislation are profiled in tab two. But Representative Sestak did introduce this National Labor Relations Modernization Act to Congress at the beginning of March. In that, he proposes the preservation of the secret ballot process. He does propose equal access for union organizers to employees during the course of a union campaign. He does propose additional or new civil penalties for employers who do engage in workplace intimidation or otherwise violate the procedures of the new legislation, and does also deal with mandatory mediation for collective bargaining agreement, but does provide a significantly longer time frame than otherwise provided in the alternative legislation. You know, in addition to these alternative legislations, there have been collection of various think groups. There's quite a bit of weighing in by several schools of thoughts regarding what is appropriate. And one of the think groups that has gotten quite a bit of press is a collection of Costco, Starbucks, and Whole Foods, who announced their Committee for a Level Playing Field. As many of you know, those three entities have been subject to very public organizing campaigns and very aggressive organizing campaigns in the last several years. But this committee did announce that their commitment and support of the secret ballot election, guaranteeing a fixed time, a specific time frame, it was not defined, for the running of the election from the time when the election petition was filed, as well as the alternative election, the alternative legislation guaranteeing equal access by union organizers to employees during the campaign process, as well as providing for increased penalties for employers who violate the new legislation. This committee does not support the mandatory arbitration provision. It does include provisions for mediation and the appointment of a federal mediator early on in the process, but does not support that there would be any binding interest arbitration that could result in a collective bargaining agreement without the mutual agreement of the company and the union. Now, what is clear from all of this is that given the status of the economy and the relatively poor state that it's in, that there is significant concern from many sides, from all sides, about the passing of the Employee Free Choice Act in its current form, particularly the provisions regarding the elimination of the secret ballot and the mandatory interest arbitration resulting in a collective bargaining agreement without the agreement of both parties. We do expect, however, that some form of legislation certainly is going to pass during this administration, and it is likely going to have many of the aspects that we focused on, including equal access of union organizers to employees during a campaign, a shortened time frame for an election to occur from the date on which the petition is filed, as well as enhanced penalties, and those penalties may well be one-sided, meaning only against the employer, for violation of the Act or any of the new pieces, parts of legislation. Bill, let me turn back to you, and if you could give us a little bit of a summary regarding right now the current process that's followed.
Sure. Before I do, Brad, I think it's worth pointing out that you're right. In this political climate, something is going to happen in the way of labor reform, and it's not going to be good for employers, whatever it is. We know that. What's happening now, and why is there such a hue and cry about the need for this reform, remains a bit of a mystery to me as to the real need. I think that many of the legislators that support these reforms are not grounded in real world realities. I mean, you look at what happened in 2008. There was something like 3,400 representation petitions that were filed by unions. A little over 2,000 of them proceeded to an election. You know, for whatever reason, the NLRB determined that it wasn't appropriate to hold an election in about 1,300 cases. But those were carefully adjudicated, I would assume, or the union withdrew the petition because it didn't have support. But that petition activity was an increase over the prior year. So union organizing activity is on the rise without this reform legislation. In 2007, unions were victorious in about 57% of the elections that were held. And in 2008, unions were victorious in 67% of the elections that were held. So unions do seem to be getting a fair shake, and they're doing well, if you look at the statistics. There have been a number of complaints by the pro-labor side in pursuing this legislation about alleged delay on the part of employers and dragging representation proceedings out for years and years, allegedly. While elections don't necessarily happen as fast as unions would like them to happen, when they have a majority of employee cards signed, sometimes without a lot of thought, they do move along pretty expeditiously now. In 2008, the median time from the filing of the petition to the conduct of an election was 38 days, a little over a month. That's not a lot of time for employees to think and for the parties to get their messages across. The 95% of all elections conducted by the NLRB in 2008 were held within 56 days of the filing of a petition. So, in fact, this so-called delay really doesn't exist. But anyway, back to current procedures. As I mentioned earlier, a union can obtain an election in an appropriate unit by filing a petition with the National Labor Relations Board that's supported by 30% of the voters in that unit. Now, many times in our experience, by the time a union files a petition, it will have 60 or even 70% of employees signed up. But unions are reluctant to go to an election when they don't have what they perceive as solid initial support. Yes? Good question, and I think it's let me attempt to answer that. There's no concrete formula for determining what's an appropriate unit. But the keystone principle is, do the employees that the union is seeking to represent have a community of interest with each other with respect to wages and other benefits and other terms and conditions of employment? So the board will conduct this community of interest analysis. And the key factors that the board considers are the employer's organizational structure, whether or not the employees in question have reasonably common supervision, or whether there's some functional integration amongst the various jobs in the unit that the union is seeking to represent. Do the employees interact frequently? Is there a similarity of working conditions? And for example, if a union sought to organize a small department within a manufacturing facility, let's say they sought to organize the drafting department and not all of the production and maintenance employees on the shop floor, the employer might well argue that that small department's not an appropriate unit, that you just can't sort of cherry pick, that those drafting employees, you know, work frequently hand in hand with or interact with employees on the floor, people in the machining shop, and that it would be disruptive to have union representation and the possibility of a strike with respect to a small segment of that overall manufacturing facility. Or a union might claim representation rights with respect to the production and maintenance shop up floor, but exclude the drafters. And the employer might take the position that it's not appropriate to exclude them, or that there are employees that the union thinks are clerical and outside of the appropriate unit, but the employer believes are not office clerical, but are plant clericals. And so there are a host of complicated issues about, you know, what's the proper voting body. But the key term is community of interest. Another key issue that the board has to decide is who's eligible to vote. Once you decide that upon the appropriate unit, there are a number of different positions that might otherwise fall within that unit. Let's say it's a broad production and maintenance unit in a manufacturing facility. Supervisors are not eligible to be in the unit. Managerial employees are not eligible. Confidential employees are not eligible. Guards are not eligible to be, they're eligible to be represented, but it has to be in a separate unit for reasons pertaining to employer security interests. What are confidential employees? Those are employees that, like an executive secretary, for example, that work closely with and share confidential information with managerial personnel that are involved in formulating and implementing labor relations policy. Who are supervisors? That's often a hotly contested issue when you deal with line supervision or people who are close to or may have risen up through the ranks of an eligible group of voters. The definition in the statute of a supervisory employee is one who has the authority to hire, fire, transfer, discharge, promote, reward, discipline, assign, or responsibly direct work, or to meaningfully, responsibly, effectively recommend any of those actions. So the authority to do any one of those supervisory responsibilities is sufficient under the statute to make that employee a supervisor, provided that in doing so, he or she exercises independent judgment and a reasonable amount of discretion, and that those last terms are where the litigation usually arises as to whether somebody is just, you know, carrying out instructions or engaged in, you know, routine, some more clerical delivery of instructions and assignments, or whether they're really engaged in meaningful supervision. And that can be a key issue, because sometimes those questionable supervisory employees may be involved in the union organizing effort. And if they're involved in a union organizing effort and they happen to be supervisors, that can taint the entire petition process, so that maybe it's not appropriate for the petition to go forward. Now, I should say that there is currently pending, or there was pending in 2007, and I think it's still, you know, in the works, an act, another piece of labor law reform that would modify the definition of supervisor. It's called the Respect Act. I forget what the acronym is for. Does anybody remember? It's not that important. But that would remove the words assign and responsibility, responsibly direct from the definition of supervisor. So it would eliminate from the exclusions, you know, a great many supervisory employees. And some of these employees are, can be important, you know, links and important tools, as Bill will discuss later, in management's communication efforts in an attempt to defeat union organizing. Lastly, on the point of supervision, the current board actually only has two members. There's supposed to be five members of the board. Three of the NLRB members are supposed to come from the majority party, which in this case now would be Democratic, and two from the minority party. Well, we have a couple of members. President Obama will fill those seats shortly. They'll have to be ratified and approved by Congress. But, you know, within the next year or so, we're going to have a democratically controlled National Labor Relations Board. What's important to remember is, unlike, you know, courts of law, where the judges pay attention to principles of what we call stare decisis, prior precedent's important, and judges are expected to follow it unless there's a very good reason. Highly unusual case where, you know, really only at the Supreme Court level could a prior precedent be overruled. Well, the National Labor Relations Board overrules prior precedent on a regular basis, depending upon who's in office. They'll change the rules on whether or not, for example, an employee who doesn't have a union representing him can have a co-worker represent him in a disciplinary interview, for example. That rule's gone back and forth three or four times over the last 20 years.
Right.
So there's no respect for precedent. And I think we can certainly expect that once the new board is constituted, when they make decisions about questions of who's a supervisor and who's not at the lower level, they're going to be much more inclined to find that the employee is not a supervisor, that applying those terms, assign and direct, they're going to say that they don't meaningfully assign and direct, they don't exercise significant discretion and judgment. The composition of the board, regardless of what happens with respect to this legislation, is going to have a significant impact on union organizing activity. Now, in dealing with these issues that I've just mentioned, there are a couple of ways for them to be addressed. And one is with a consent agreement for an election. And that often happens, where the union and the employer will get together under the supervision of the board and agree upon a time for the election, a place for the election, and they will agree upon who belongs in the unit, who's eligible to vote, and who's not. And if that's the case, there's no need for a hearing, no need for the board to resolve anything. On the other hand, if the parties can't agree, then the NLRB has to conduct a hearing. The NLRB is broken down, by the way, into three different segments. One is that the adjudicative National Labor Relations Board that makes the final decisions on representation petitions and unfair labor practice charges. And within that, there's an administrative law judge division to hear the cases, and then the board reviews the law judge's decisions. Throughout the country, there are regional offices, and each of those offices is run by a regional director. We have a region here in Boston. We have a region in Hartford. There's one in New York, and on and on. And the regional director is the NLRB official who is primarily responsible for handling the election issues. The Office of the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board is responsible for prosecuting unfair labor practice charges before the board. So the regional director will conduct a hearing. There'll be a hearing officer, you know, who works for this region. Could be a lawyer, might not be a lawyer. Who will conduct a hearing within typically seven, they'll try to push for a hearing within 7, 10, no more than 14 days from the date of the petition. Clearly, if the statute is amended to mandate a 21-day period for holding an election, well, frankly, I can't conceive of how you can have a hearing on complicated, difficult issues that's going to take place, be concluded, fully briefed, and decided within 21 days. I mean, it seems to me that's going to be an impossibility, but that's what the senators are considering. So you have the hearing, you know, whenever it takes place. Each side typically is represented by counsel. Employers are almost always represented by counsel. Sometimes unions are not, but they usually are. There's a right to put in evidence, documentary evidence, regarding your position on the composition of the unit or whether somebody's a supervisor or not. Might be disciplinary actions that a supervisor's been involved in that have been documented, and you put those in as exhibits. There can be cross-examination by each side. It's conducted much like a trial with one key exception, and that is that for reasons I've never really been able to understand, this is viewed to be, quote, not an adversary proceeding. Well, it's very much an adversary proceeding, but literally the regional director does not consider it to be adversary. And what that means is that the regional director does not make credibility resolutions. So somehow they have to come to a decision without making credibility resolutions as to whether or not somebody's telling the truth or not, which makes it a little complicated as well. So sometimes these hearings can take days or weeks if they're complicated enough. And once the hearing is closed, the parties have an opportunity to file briefs. I think typically the rule is you file a brief within 7 days. Often there are extensions. Again, if this 21-day or truncated period from petition to election takes place, the people who are really going to suffer are the lawyers, because they're going to have to write a brief in 24 hours. And I think the message there, and we'll get into this in more detail, is if you have a reasonable risk of unionization, if you're vulnerable to unionization, you have to do a lot of your preparation before you even hear of a campaign. Your lawyers ought to know, you know, what an appropriate unit is, so that they can respond quickly. There's not going to be time to dig. If you've got a notice for a hearing to be before the NLRB in 2 days after getting the petition, how do you have time to put together your case about appropriate unit or, you know, who's excluded? What are the timing issues with respect to an election? I told you what the statistics are. How does the board push this forward? Generally, as a rule of thumb, the regional director, I think, would say, and Bill, correct me if I'm wrong about this, they like to say that they'll insist on an election in a consent agreement within 42 days of the date of the petition. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not cast in stone, because the parties can agree to something beyond that, but any agreement has to be approved by the regional director. Now, what is the regional director going to do if both parties agree to a 50-day period and he or she doesn't want it? Well, the only recourse is to hold a hearing, which might result in more delay. So for the most part, unless it's unreasonable, the party's agreement is going to control. If there's no agreement and there's a hearing, then the board regulations say that once the regional director issues a decision on, you know, all of the issues, the appropriate unit, and directs an election, the election has to take place between the 25th and the 30th day from the date that the election is directed.
Right.
Once the election is directed, the regional director will order the employer to submit a list of eligible voters, which contains not only the names but their home addresses. That's called the Excelsior list. It's the name is derived from a case back in the 1940s and 1950s called involving a company called Excelsior Underwear, and that's when the board came up with that rule that in order for there to be, you know, a free and fair, you know, election by a fully informed electorate, the union would, you know, need to be able to campaign. They don't have access usually to the employer premises, so they should have the names and addresses of the voters. Between the direction of the election and the election, and indeed even before the direction of the election, the employer is doing what it should be doing. There's a campaign going on. Should the employees choose a union or not? A bedrock principle of the current National Labor Relations Act is that the employer has a free speech right. The employer has the right to express its opinions and to tell employees, quite frankly, that it doesn't think that a union would be good for this particular facility, that it's not, you know, appropriate or necessary, and to explain all of the reasons why, as long as it doesn't make any statements or take any actions that are threatening or coercive It can't promise benefits, it can't grant benefits, it can't take things away. Generally speaking, and this is shorthand, there's an acronym called TIPS. This is what you can't do. No threats, no intimidation, no promises or grants of benefits, and no surveillance or spying on employees. Those that don'ts, there are a lot of do's, and we'll get into those in a few minutes. Fundamentally, what the NLRB is charged with doing is ensuring as best it can that the election proceedings are conducted in what it refers to as, quote, laboratory conditions. I forget why they came up with that term, but it basically means as best as possible to ensure that the employees have an opportunity to exercise their free choice in an atmosphere that is conducive to the free exercise of their rights, and that there isn't any coercion or undue influence on the voters. The election's conducted, as I said before, in a secret ballot process. Typically, the election takes place at the premises of the employer. It's supposed to be conducted under the board protocols in a non-managerial setting, so you wouldn't have it in a manager's office. You'll have it in a lunchroom, a cafeteria, a break room, some place where employees are comfortable and where employees can vote without other people observing how they're voting. The new board is very technical about this. They want to make sure that there aren't any windows that can't be covered up so that somebody might peer in from outside and get an angle look at the employee as he fills out a ballot. But it really isn't very hard to set that up. The NLRB agent comes in with a ballot box. It's a little black box that's set up on a stand, or sometimes they put it on a table. And the employees will come in and vote. They're checked off. There's the list of eligible voters that I mentioned earlier, and the NLRB agent will check them off. The employer and the union can each select observers. The only restriction is that the observers can't be supervisory employees. The purpose of the observer is to be the eyes and ears of the party, to make sure that nothing inappropriate happened during the balloting. Now the NLRB representative is going to make sure of that, but each side has a chance to sort of monitor the behavior of the NLRB representative. The rules provide that there can't be any electioneering while the voting is going on. So electioneering and any kind of attempt in the balloting area by either party to influence a voter would be a ground for potentially setting aside an election. So the balloting takes place. There may be challenged ballots. The observers are typically instructed that there are certain people who are going to vote that are questionable. Sometimes the board doesn't decide a supervisory issue at the hearing. They may put it off because it might not even affect the outcome of the election. So ballots are challenged. If a voter shows up and his or her name doesn't appear on the voter list, that the board representative will challenge that ballot. What's that mean? That ballot is put in an envelope, sealed, and kept aside. At the conclusion of the voting, the ballot box is opened and the ballots are taken out, and the employee either checks box the no box or the yes box. And then, the yeses are put on one pile and the noes in another pile, and whoever has a majority of the votes cast is the winner. And it's not a majority of those in the voting unit, it's a majority of the votes cast, so it's really important for employees to vote, or it's basically not voting is a vote for the union, because the union supporters are going to be voting. If you have 100 employees in the appropriate voting unit and only 50 vote, then 26 employees can select the representative, despite the fact that there are 100 people in the unit. After the voting, there's a 7-day period for either side to object to the conduct of the election, and that means not just the balloting process, but everything that went on before it in the campaign. And during that time, it's not unusual for a union that's lost an election to file unfair labor practice charges to file objections based on conduct that the union claims is coercive. It may be, for example, that during the course of the election, the employer granted a wage increase, and the employer's justification for granting the wage increase was that typically at that time of the year it grants wage increases and merit increases, and that's often a hotly debated and difficult issue. But if the employer didn't grant the wage increase, it might be responsible for an unfair labor practice because it withheld a benefit that it should have granted. So there are a lot of complicated issues there, but objections are filed, and if objections are filed, the board investigates. If it finds merit to the objections, it can set aside the election and have a second election run. There's frequently, if there's some merit, potential merit to an objection, there'll be a hearing conducted much like the representation hearing. And ultimately, down the road, once the regional director makes a decision with respect to the objections, the employer has, or the union, had the right to appeal to the National Labor Relations Board in Washington. I think that's a pretty comprehensive summary of current law, Brad. And I guess what I would like to do, if I could, is turn it over to Bill at this point. Bill, let's talk a bit about what happened. Yes.
Employees hear the facts and may determine in their own mind that because they're hearing the facts, that's a threat.
You're right. You're right.
Against their particular position.
Absolutely. There are a lot of unfair labor practice charges that are filed over what employers say in the campaign, and employees can spin it. They may not even be fabricating it. They may not be, you know, dishonest. They may just have heard it that way because it's their mindset. A lot of these issues are ambiguous. For example, you can't threaten to close a plant because the employees vote for a union. You can't, but you can point to the fact that at other union facilities, plants have been closed or employees have been laid off. In some circumstances, you can make, you know, reasoned, factually based predictions, but you can't make threats. Now, there's a very fine line. That's an awfully nuanced concept, and it's fertile ground for disputes about what was actually said, which can, if they look at it from one angle, it can be an unfair labor practice or conduct that's sufficient to justify a second election. Or in some cases, the board even has the authority to do away with the concept of a second election, and if the employer unfair labor practices are egregious, if there have been a number of firings of union adherents because they were in favor of the union, if the employer has granted benefits or taken away benefits and made threats, and the accumulation of that in the board's judgment makes it impossible to have a fair second election, if the union had a majority of cards, of the employees in the unit's cards at the time it filed the petition, the board can be authorized to order the employer to bargain despite the fact that the employer won the election. So back to Bill. Bill, let's say you get a call. Your client has just received a petition. This is to follow from my examples. It's a manufacturing facility. Let's say they've got 150, 200 employees. And a petition's been filed with the board. They just got notice of it. Frankly, it comes as a surprise to them.
Often
what
is.
What do you do today?
Good morning, everybody. First of all, we're really first responders when such an event occurs, and it's obviously a very busy time because there's so many things to be done and so many things to learn from the get-go. Our role basically is to be campaign managers for the organization, and the on-site folks who are giving the strategic advice that hopefully is going to lead to the prevailing of the organization's position to maintain non-union status. How do we do that? Well, basically, we basically have to be successful in two areas. One, we have to educate the employees who are going to be eligible to vote, or who we think are going to be eligible to vote, regarding the question on the ballot, the party on the ballot, and what they may or may not know about this process, about what happens should, in fact, the union be successful and collective bargaining ensue, all of those things. And that's obviously critical and something that has to happen very quickly once the union effort is become apparent. Secondly, and more importantly, in my judgment, is to demonstrate to the employees during the campaign period that management is a better choice than the party on the ballot. And that is the point that is often missed. A lot of people think, erroneously in my judgment, that what you have to do when you've got union activities, go out there and bash the union, and that will be enough. And I've seen a lot of union bashing that has resulted in a union victory because the employer has forgotten that employees are not happy or they wouldn't be doing this. Employees are not born into the world with a desire to join the Teamsters. It's an acquired taste. And they acquired it at the work site. So an employer, and this happens all the time, and sometimes you read about these in the newspaper, who is out there holding meetings and forcing people to watch films and beating the union up by talking about the mafia and that sort of thing, when they are not addressing in any way, shape, or form, difficult though it is, given the restrictions that Bill pointed out, what our view is on the issues of the day, and trying to find ways to demonstrate that we, A, are capable of representing people's interests, want to represent their interests, and quite frankly think that there are good reasons not to select the party on the ballot. That's a much more difficult thing to do, but in my judgment, it's the more important of the two. Both of those things have got to be done in a very timely fashion. So as I said, there's a lot of important things that have to be decided right away. Some of the key questions for people like yours truly in a campaign, first of all, what's the time frame? If we're under petition, that gives me a pretty good idea of what we're talking about because there's nothing we can do to stop the process from going forward. Once the petition's been filed, the National Labor Relations Board is in charge of the process, and the only party that can stop it is the party that filed it. So whoever that individual is, usually a union rep who filed a petition with the NLRB, that's the only party that can withdraw it. All the employees could decide the day after the petition was filed that they no longer wish to pursue this and the process goes forward. So the time frame is critically important. In Bill's example, petition has already been filed, so that means that a hearing has been scheduled probably within a week to 10 days. And as Bill pointed out, your labor council is going to be representing you. We'd be very interested in sitting down with labor council to see if, in fact, there are any hearing issues that we can come up with. And hopefully there are. And Bill touched on some of them. The reason for that is we're great believers in having a hearing. We don't like consent elections because consent elections means you're basically going in and shaking hands with the union, something that we don't think is a very good idea, particularly at the beginning of a campaign, when one of the arguments you're going to make is that collective bargaining could be difficult and could be could take an extended period of time. How do you make that argument when the first time you came across the union, you made an agreement with them in 5 seconds? It kind of makes you look a little bit two-faced, in my judgment. Plus the fact that having a hearing is nothing other than getting due process. The National Labor Relations Board is there, supported by our tax money, to run elections. It's one of the two functions that they have. And to try to find a way to quicken that process is not in the employer's best interest. Time is the union's enemy in a campaign because what it does, it wears down the emotional attraction that the union has in the first place. That's what their campaign is built on. People have come to the union usually and said, we're upset, we're unhappy because we're not making enough money, we don't like the supervision, we don't like the way the organization is run, we don't like our supervision, whatever it might be. And the union's job is to play on that emotion and create a view of the future that is built on satisfying that emotion. Well, anything that happens that slows the process down and rejects the union's argument that this is a very quick and simple process, you vote us in, we go in, we negotiate a contract, and you get everything you want. That sounds wonderful and is very attractive if it's not rebutted appropriately. One of the ways to do that is to have the process slow the thing down. And it's not the employer who is slowing it down. Unions don't like it when you have to go to, when you insist on a hearing. But if a union has taken a position when they filed their petition that you think is in question, you have every right, as my friends here will tell you, to raise these issues before the labor board at the hearing and say, wait a minute, we think the union's petition cherry picks our employee population, for example. I had a case a few years ago in New Hampshire in a manufacturing organization where the employer had a satellite 20 minutes away from the main facility. The satellite was completely ignored by the union when they filed their petition. giving us the opportunity to demonstrate that these folks have every right, if there's going to be an election, to be participants, because there is a community of interest that we can demonstrate between them. And the union had a very difficult choice to make. Did they want to let us go on the record and eat up 4 or 5 days of hearing time, which is going to allow us to have our attorneys get a week or two for briefs, and then the board's going to have to pore over all this for 2 or 3 more weeks before they issue a decision, which is going to give us another 4 weeks after that? Or do they give in and agree with us, which they sometimes will, and say, well, what do you want? And the employer said, well, we think all these people should vote. And that increased the voting unit by 30%. Well, the union drive was basically over that day. I mean, I knew who was going to win. It was just a question of the count, because you can't give away that many votes at the outset and hope to prevail. And the union felt they had to, because they thought the hearing process would be too long. So, again, we're great believers in having a hearing, because it demonstrates that, contrary to what the union has possibly represented, this is not a simple process. It's not an easy process. And, in fact, you have a right to due process, just as the union does. And due process in this case means, if there are differences, the NLRB is the appropriate party to decide who should be voting, for example, and who should not. So we're great believers in that. What is the unit in question? Obviously, something that we would be interested in, and I just discussed that. How accurate is it in our view? And that war story I just gave you is an excellent example where just having the hearing itself and having legitimate issues is enough to turn the thing around eventually, and is the main cause for prevailing. Who is the union? How active is this organization? Now, a union that doesn't file many petitions is going to make a lot more mistakes than somebody who does this all the time. Unions like the Service Employees International Union, the Communication Workers of America, the Teamsters, these are people that are very active. They file a lot of petitions. They know the game. And so you can expect a much tougher ride with folks like that than with somebody who hasn't done this very often, for one reason or another. Another thing that I'm interested in is, what have they done so far? What literature, if any? What is their approach? That tells me what they have been told by the folks who are unfriendly. What kind of issues does the union think are hot? What are they pressing? Those are things that we're going to probably have to respond to in some way, shape, or form, because the union has been led to believe that's what brought this on in the first place. All these things are critical for us to get at, and at the same time, we must do some other things as well. Number one, we have to learn the history and the culture of the organization that we're there to serve as quickly as we can, and that means sitting down with senior management, sitting down with the human resources people, typically, and to, as quickly as we can, assimilate it, and you get pretty good at this after a while. Who is this organization? How long have they been around? What's the history? What's the labor history? Why, in their view, are we having this particular issue now? Why didn't we have it a year ago or 5 years ago? What's their view of the issues in question? And also, what steps, if any, has the client already taken? Because we don't want to go about recommending something that is going to look contrary or vastly different than what has already taken place. My hope is usually that they haven't done too much before we get there, so that we can all start from the same page. We also have to think about our position. Have we communicated it yet? If we have not, then a typical job for yours truly is to sit down and draft something after talking to some of these individuals, putting together our position so that we can start our campaign with a public declaration to our employees who are going to be eligible to vote, what our position is, why we have taken it, what are the steps that are about to take place, so that our employees learn two things from that initial communication. Number one, what has happened and what's about to happen in layman's terms, so that they understand clearly what's ahead. We become the source of accurate information, not the union. Secondly, what is our take on this whole thing? It's no secret that Harvard University clerical employees were unionized about 20 years ago. Harvard's position when they were petitioned originally was to take no position. They thought it would be inappropriate for them. Quite frankly, they didn't think it would be nice to get their hands dirty in a campaign, and so they decided not to say anything. And they wound up losing the election by about 40 votes. And you know, without even looking, that an organization that loses an election with over 3,000 people voting, which is very hard to do, would have won the election if they had only said once that we don't think this is a good idea. They would have prevailed, no doubt in my mind. But they never did that until it was over. And they decided to fight the process, which is a little late in the day. And today they have 5,000 clericals who are unionized as a result of that campaign. It's another thing about these elections. It's a winner-take-all thing, and unlike voting for Congress or for president, it's not going to come up every 4 years. This is it. If you lose, chances are that you're going to be unionized for the next 100 years. So you really have to concentrate on the steps that you take.
Hey, so, Bill, just if I could interrupt for a second. Once you have sized this up, how do you get the message across? And how do you, I mean, what do you do to convince people in a non-coercive way that a union is not right? I mean, are there any key things to avoid or practices that you will typically follow?
Jumping a little bit ahead of myself, once we have our initial communication out, and oftentimes, by the way, this takes the form, if the unit is of a size that you mentioned, Bill, 150-odd people or less, of a letter, typically from the CEO, president, because you're trying to stress the importance of this issue, and that helps to do that. So you want this message to come from the top of the organization, at least initially, and stating the things that I mentioned earlier. And it's in a form which can be distributed hand-to-hand from frontline supervisors and managers to employees. I think it was Tip O'Neill who said all politics are local, and establishing that and reinforcing that relationship between the supervisor and the employee is, in our view, critical to us. The supervisors and the department managers and folks like that are the precinct captains, if you will. This is very much like a political campaign. And again, where are you likeliest to get the best response? You're likeliest to get it from the people that the voters know best, and whom might they be? The folks that they work with every day, and who happily do not have the protections of the Act, so you can direct those folks appropriately to take the position and to share the position that the employer has put forward. To answer Bill's question, really what we spend a lot of time doing, as my friends in the back can testify, is we spend a lot of time with those supervisors, not only tracking the progress of the campaign, but to try to get a handle from their perspective, because they're the people on the firing line every day, what the issues are in their locale, in their region, in their department, in their precinct, if you will, okay? And what kinds of things are they looking for? What kinds of solutions do they think would make this better? And then we have to find ways to demonstrate that we are capable of putting those solutions forward without ever violating the National Labor Relations Act. We don't think it does much good if the employer prevails in an election if it's going to be overturned on objections by the union because of our illegal conduct. And unfortunately, that happens all too often. And quite frankly, in our opinion, it shouldn't. You should be able to run a campaign that is very forceful, where you take the offensive very, very early on, never give it up, never allow the union to put you on the defensive, and to make sure that they are on the defensive all the time. Why? Because you can say with a straight face, the union is the only party on the ballot. You are not on the ballot. The question on the ballot literally is, do you wish to be represented for the purposes of collective bargaining by the XYZ union? Not do you like your employer. The government doesn't care whether you like the employer. The government wants to know, do you want to keep this table of organization that you now have? That's who represents the employees today, is it not? Yes. Or would you like to swap all of them for this external third party to whom you are probably going to be paying money for the privilege of representing you? And if you have a group of leadership people, which often is the case, who have credibility, who have done things for people time and time again, probably don't even think about it because they're good people or you wouldn't have them there, and who have provided excellent representation to people, you've got a tremendous head start. Unions can go out and hire attorneys. They do. They can go out and hire consultants to counter folks like me. But one thing they cannot do, they can never take the place of credible managers and supervisors, particularly at the local level. And if I have that going in, that campaign should be victorious in the end.
Bill, what happens if you don't? Or what if it's mixed? I mean, presumably if the employees aren't happy, they file a petition, there's something wrong somewhere. And what if you encounter a situation where a significant group of employees are being managed by somebody who is not a credible effect?
Well, you typically have to make a judgment, or the organization has to make a judgment, that they want to send some signals to these employees that change is either on the way or it has already taken place. And the most extreme example, and happily this doesn't come up very often, an employer might move somebody out of there. I've had that experience in the last couple of years with somebody where you knew that that individual, for reasons that are much too complex to go into, had no chance of recovering credibility, certainly not in the time frame that we had, and it would be much better for the organization if they weren't there. Okay? And what does that do? It sends a signal to people that the organization is capable of making change. Or, in the case of my friends in the back, it was possible to build a campaign around an individual who has newly arrived and who has all of the voters under his or her charge, so that you can say with a straight face to people, yes, there are issues here, and yes, we think they are legitimate issues, and while we are not able to make promises to you because the law does not allow us to, unlike the union who is allowed to make promises, we want to demonstrate to you that we are worthy of getting an opportunity to show you what we can do. And a person who is brand new or is not guilty of any of these sins of the past can say that with a straight face. Hey, I'm here. I'm interested in what happened in the past, but what I'm really interested in is the future going forward and our future together. And hopefully that person can demonstrate some things even in the course of the campaign that gives people hope that if they put this aside, if only for a year, because they can have an election in one more year if they're not happy with the results that they see, and give that employer a chance, which is all you're asking for. It's all you want is one chance. We're not asking people to vote no forever. We're asking them to vote no this time, because that's all we care about is this time. Because if the employer is as good as we think they are, they're never going to have a second time. Very, very rarely do employers have to go back and do this thing over again because they didn't learn enough the first time that they go through it, because it's not a fun process.
But, you know, so, Bill, if the EFCA were enacted,
well,
everything you've just described, it seems to me, is out of the picture.
It's a lot harder.
You don't get a chance to kick into action, and this campaign doesn't go forward because the union shows up on the doorstep with 51 cards out of 100 employees in a unit. And I think what we're going to do in a few minutes is to talk about what employers need to do today to be in the best position to avoid vulnerability to that kind of a campaign. And I'm going to ask you a few questions about that in a minute. But before we do, I think I'd like to just ask Brad if he could talk a bit about what, if any, restrictions employers can place today on union activity, union organizing activity, or access by professional union organizers to company premises and that kind of a thing.
I'm going to just describe some of those legitimate restrictions an employer can impose. The materials I'm talking about are at tab 5. I'm going to try to move through it quickly, just see if we can catch up a little. One is that if an employer wants to prohibit non-employee organizers from their premises, from being on their premises speaking to employees regarding a union campaign, they have to have a policy prohibiting them, and that policy has got to be enforced. There's two pieces. It's got to be a policy, but the company, most importantly, cannot relax that policy and not enforce it. If they want to choose to prohibit those organizers from their premises, it has to be uniformly enforced. Now, same thing with respect to employees. An employer can develop a policy that prohibits solicitation by an employee during work time or during a manner that would otherwise interfere with the work time of the employee being spoken to. But again, that policy regarding non-solicitation has to be developed and it needs to be enforced. What can't occur is that the policy can't be discriminatorily enforced against a union and relaxed with respect to other aspects. Now, recently, the Register Guard decision, which was a 2007 decision issued by the National Labor Relations Board, did deal with both, you know, email solicitation and the circumstances when that can occur lawfully, but also the discrimination analysis. And I'm going to speak to both of those issues quickly. Now, in the Register Guard decision, the employer there had a policy that prohibited the use of email by employees for any non-job related solicitation. That was their published policy. Now, the union in Register Guard said, well, that policy as a matter of law is unlawful. And the union argued, they said, email has evolved into a method of communication that is very similar to face-to-face communication. And they tried to convince the board and say, look, you know, you need to understand that what email has become. It is one of the primary means of communicating between employees in the workplace. One or two sentences back and forth, more extensive communication, hundreds of times a day. And so for an employer to simply say, no non-job related solicitations via email is in essence a prohibition on speech. And that prohibition on speech, therefore, is unlawful because it's an unfair prohibition that's facially invalid. That's what the union argued. The Register Guard board, however, found that email was really no different than any other employer-owned mechanism, like a telephone, like a bulletin board, and said, well, an employer can put restrictions on that equipment, on employee use of that equipment to communicate when they're soliciting. Mm-hmm. And as long as the company is not discriminating against the union and enforcing that rule, it's a lawful rule. Now, one important point. We do believe that the newly comprised Obama board will revisit at their earliest opportunity the reasoning in Register Guard. Yeah. Most pundits believe that the Obama board will reverse Register Guard and determine that an email communication is more like face-to-face talk, and that a blanket prohibition on the use of employee use of an email to prohibit solicitation is facially invalid. So we do believe that that is coming. Secondly, we also believe that the Obama board will alter the discrimination analysis. Now, while the Register board, they took a more macro level of discrimination. They said, well, you know, as long as the company does not discriminate in the particular type of solicitation, then it's lawful. In other words, for example, an employer under the current law could say, I'm going to permit charitable solicitations, but I'm going to prohibit non-charitable solicitations. So the examination was, well, how does the employer treat solicitations of that nature, charitable or non-charitable solicitations? I'm going to permit a personal invitation that an employee sends to someone else, you know, non-work related, a personal invitation, but I'm going to prohibit invitations to join an organization. That would be unlawful discriminatory conduct. It's looked at that micro level. Now, we do believe, however, that once again, that the Obama board will change that analysis to prohibit that micro discriminatory analysis and revert to the pre-Register Guard analysis. And therefore, as a result of that, in light of that, each of you should understand what your practice and policy is regarding non-solicitation for non-job related communications and solicitations in the workplace. And then, how is that policy applied? How is it enforced with respect to, you know, personal communications, personal non-business solicitations, invitations that employees may make, you know, blanket emails that occur? Do you require employees to engage in sale, for example, of personal goods or solicitation for, you know, particular events on the email system? Do you require that they go to a particular bulletin board on that email system? Do you counsel employees if they use the greater, you know, email system? Hey, you know, for if you want to post interest in tickets or this, you know, purely personal thing, you need to use this section of the communication where employees, if they choose, can go to just look to those, because that's where those non-job related communications are occurring. You need to understand how that policy works with respect to your organization. Also, you need to obviously be aware of the upcoming changes in the law in this area, because they're certainly going to happen.
But currently, right now, as I understand it, Brad, with Register Guard, the employers can make those kinds of distinctions and permit charitable solicitations. They could permit employees to use the bulletin boards or emails for personal, non-organizational solicitation.
Yes. Yeah.
But you have to be careful that they don't cross the line. And what you can't do is permit commercial solicitation, because that's too akin to union type activity.
That's correct.
And you just got to keep an eye on it, because the law is likely to change, and these policies have to be drafted pretty carefully and enforced pretty solidly.
Bill, close to the solicitation distribution rules is union organizer access to company property. Can you describe just quickly some of the rules regarding that?
Yeah, I can do this pretty quickly. I mean, I think the fundamental rule is union organizers should not have a right of access to employer property in the usual circumstances, if the employer has an appropriately posted and properly enforced non-solicitation, non-distribution rule. So those rules are really important, and it's important that they be established before there's any union organizing activity, because the board has held that once those rules, if those rules are put into effect at the time of union activity, that they're sort of almost per se discriminatory, because the intent is obvious. So typically, an employer has a right to enforce its property rights, and non-employees don't have a right to attempt to organize or campaign or solicit on company property. Unions can engage in picketing activity in support of organizational drives. Again, they can't do that on company property in the ordinary circumstance. And the Act says that they can't engage in that picketing activity for the purpose of trying to force an employer to recognize the union as the representative for more than 30 days unless they file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board seeking an election. Actually, if they file the petition, they can continue to picket, but there's an end in sight because there's going to be an election. There are some exceptions if the picketing is unduly coercive. If there's mass picketing, they may not be able to continue that, and they can't do it on employer premises. There is one exception under the current law to the union access to property rule, and that is if the union has no other reasonable alternative means of communicating with the employees. But just about any means in this modern, communication, high technology environment is going to be viewed as reasonable, be it advertising or letters or television broadcasting or radio ads, whatever. The only circumstance that I'm aware of now that would give a union access to employer property, even with an appropriate no solicitation rule, would be in the old, company town concept in the hills of West Virginia back in the 30s or 40s, where there'd be a company town and employees would reside on the employer premises. You just don't see that today. So practically speaking, there should be no union organizer access. Brad, if we move this along, we promised everybody that we'd talk a little bit more about the do's and the don'ts, so-called, in a campaign. Can you highlight some of the do's and the don'ts?
And the do's and don'ts are in tab 8 of your materials. Importantly, as Bill Bray did emphasize, it is absolutely critical to educate your frontline supervisors, be confident that they can effectively communicate with the employees. What many companies and supervisors occasionally, if there is a campaign, they're reluctant to speak. They think, gee, maybe I just shouldn't communicate. Maybe I have to just not, speak about this. That frequently can be fatal to a company's ability to successfully defend against a union campaign. What is important is that those supervisors state their opinion. They need to, when they have an opportunity, develop credibility with their employees. Now, hand in hand, if they're providing facts, those facts have got to be accurate. They need to be truthful. They need to be accurate. But management needs to be seen as a source of credible information, as a source of facts. The union frequently is going to be making promises that are inaccurate, are going to be providing descriptions that are simply not truthful. Eventually, employees are going to figure that out. But if managers and supervisors can effectively communicate in a credible way with their employees, it goes a long ways to be able to defeating a union campaign. tell employees that they can achieve on their own. Whatever a union's promising, that there should be no impediment that they cannot get through on their own. Let them know that they're free not to join the union, and that the company firmly believes that a union in our organization is not in the employee's best interest. That simple opinion, it is critical that has to be stated. Bill Bray referenced the Harvard campaign, where it was never articulated in that simple a fashion. Remind employees that at present they are receiving competitive wages and benefits. And Bill's going to talk in a moment about how critical it is to be able to understand and present that, in fact, they are receiving competitive wages and benefits. That is frequently a significant touchstone for a union. And point out to employees, obviously, that in the event that there is a successful campaign, that they will not be able to deal directly with management anymore, but rather will be dealing solely through a union. In addition to stating opinion, educate employees. Tell them that they're not obligated to talk to union organizers who may show up. Tell them that signing an authorization card could lead in some limited circumstances to a union being certified without an election, and could result in their obligation to pay union fees and dues. Remind employees that because of the realities of the bargaining process, a union cannot obtain more than what the company is willing to give. And that a union can't prevent a layoff to the extent that one is necessary. To the extent that the union that is organizing a community does in fact have a strike history, educate your employees about that strike history, the length of it, and the cost to employees that result. And most importantly, assure that company rules are enforced. Keep union non-employee organizers off the company property, and ensure that discussions of union affairs be done consistent with the company's non-distribution, non-solicitation policy.
On that score too, Brad, it's not just with respect to union activity and enforcing the non-solicitation rule, but also, just because somebody's a union organizer, an employee union organizer or actively supporting the union, that doesn't mean they don't have to abide by company rules. They don't get extra protection. Now, they may be subject to unfair labor practice charges if you discipline such an employee, but on the other hand, the employees need to know who's running the workforce, and you can't get away with murder just because you're in favor of a union, and you can enforce the rules.
In summary, in terms of the dues, in addition to expressing personal opinion, one-to-one communications with employees are key. The credible relationship that a direct supervisor has with a subordinate employee is absolutely essential to be able to effectively marshaling a vote no campaign. And encouraging employees to ask questions, to engage in a process, an analytical process regarding whether or not the union is necessary, again, essential. On the don'ts, you heard about the acronym TIPS. Obviously, threats, intimidation, promises, or surveillance are each unlawful. The union is just waiting for it to happen so that they can file charges and they can, and then turn around and use the fact of those charges in connection with their campaign. So it's relatively simple, although some of your supervisors may wrongly believe that by engaging in that control can result in a vote no. It always has the opposite impact.
And one last point on the promises or grants of benefits. Within that is the concept that you can't go out and solicit grievances with the implicit promise to remedy them. And of course, that presents a complication for an effective management tool for avoiding or beating a union in an organizing campaign is getting employees to understand that we can fix things. How do you do that? Well, if you have an effective program of communicating with employees and having focus group meetings and soliciting employee concerns and complaints before a union ever arrives on the scene, you've got a perfect right to continue to do that. So if you can't
start a process of soliciting grievances and complaints and gripes and remedying them if you haven't done it before. But if you have that system in place, you can continue it. And Bill, I think we ought to move along at this point to what employers need to do today in light of the impending threat of some type of labor law reform that's going to adversely affect the employer's right to campaign.
Right, and as quickly as I can, as I think was mentioned earlier by Bill, whatever is going to happen once this fog clears on the legislative front in Washington, it's not going to be good for employers who wish to maintain non-union status. And since the process that we discussed earlier, the organizing process, is probably going to be altered in some way that is beneficial to unions and not to the folks in this room, it's particularly important to be proactive now. So there's a bunch of things that we think an employer can do right now and should do right now to build up their resistance should, in fact, you wind up in the crosshairs of a union organizing drive. The first one is to identify and educate the management and supervisory team. You have to know who your statutory supervisory personnel are. Most of those, it's easy to tell who's supervisory and who is not, but on the close calls, that's where you need labor counsel's input. And it's important to have these folks on your side confident, and when I say confident, I mean confident in discussing this subject, which means training. Obviously, we spend a lot of time doing that at times like this, running training seminars and things of that nature, as my friends here do as well, just so that frontline leadership people will know something about the subject and something about the likely opponents who might be targeting you. And to be ready on day one, because again, you're not going to have the kind of days in terms of number that we used to have once we had the process that Bill walked you through earlier, when we had several bites at the apple and could string the thing out. Secondly, conducting a bargaining unit analysis. What would constitute an appropriate bargaining unit, or excuse me, a voting unit? It's only a bargaining unit if you lose the election. But what would constitute an appropriate voting unit? You can find that out now by sitting again with labor counsel and describing your organization. They could tip you off as to what that is so that you know pretty accurately what it is that you'd have to defend. Thirdly, conducting vulnerability assessments for each of those potential bargaining units is incredibly important, because it identifies those sectors of your organization that are most in need of attention right now. Bill talked about maintaining competitive wage and benefit programs. Obviously, it's a common issue in most campaigns, and it's wonderful to be able to say that to people, that in fact we are competitive, but if you're not, people are going to know that you're not, and obviously you don't have that argument. So you want to make sure that for benchmark jobs in your region, in your area, that you are competitive not only with non-union employers, but with union contracts, because if you're not, you'll be seeing those union contracts during the campaign that ensues. Number five, communicating employers' position on unions and advantages of a union-free workplace. We think that starts early on with things like an employee handbook. We think there should be a statement in that handbook on unions, very easily drafted by folks sitting to my left and right who can help you with that if, in fact, you don't have it. So people coming into your organization know that you have a point of view, and it's certainly a legitimate point of view, and it can be worded appropriately so that there's no doubt in people's minds where you stand on this critical issue. Also, to build in some training for new employees on this subject, for example, about card signing and whatnot, when they're in orientation, as opposed to ignoring this subject, which you might wind up doing to your peril, given the potential changes in the law that are about to take place. Six, develop an employee education program regarding significance of union authorization cards. I alluded to this a moment ago, but again, this can be continued in staff meetings. For example, when there's organizing activity in your particular area, not a bad time to bring that sort of thing up in a staff meeting, so it doesn't sound as though you're taking something out of whole cloth. You're just reporting on something that is current. Number seven, develop an early warning system for card signing. You know, people ask us all the time, well, how do you know something's going on? And the short answer to that question is, well, you look for aberrant behavior. And one way to find that out is to get with your frontline supervisory people, but they in turn should be staying in touch with your opinion leaders, the people who in a campaign would be your best friends, your advocates, the people who think that a union is a bad idea, who have a lot of credibility with their peers. It's critically important to know who those people are and to stay in touch with those folks, because again, they would be the first folks to know if something was amiss at the employee level. And if you have a relationship there, it certainly would come in handy. Prepare campaign research packages for your likeliest opponents. You know, if you're in retail, the United Food and Commercial Workers, the folks who are after Walmart, that would probably be a likely opponent of yours. If you're in manufacturing, it could be the Machinist Union or the Teamsters Union or the Electrical Workers Union or any number of other heavy industry type folks. If you're in healthcare, it's the Service Employees International Union. But right now, getting from the Department of Labor things like their constitutions and bylaws, which are public documents, their current financial statements, having those things already on hand saves a lot of time. Again, these are not things that necessarily have to be done under the process that we have enjoyed all this time, but that process, as we indicated earlier, is about to change. Similarly, number nine, develop campaign core messages and materials really unnecessary under the current setup, because we would have time to do that even if we were under petition. But again, with a shortened time frame, it's important to have a pretty good idea what a message to employees would look like if you did have card signing. What would you say to people? What would you describe to them? What points would you make in your initial communique? How would you put forward your position? It would not be too soon today to start putting together ideas on those tasks, as well as to compile your treasure chest on the items that I mentioned earlier, contracts regarding specific unions, their bylaws, their financial statements, what have you. And lastly, providing periodic union awareness updates for managers and supervisors. For example, if you have, and I hope you do have, regularly scheduled departmental meetings where you not only talk about issues and resolution of problems that are occurring in that particular area, but you also use it as a forum to update people on what's happening in the region. There's just been a layoff at the XYZ company down the road. 40 people were involved, blah, blah, blah. Happily, we do not face this kind of thing. Those kinds of updates are very, very useful, particularly when they involve things that are happening in the labor field and problems, for example, that are occurring that a labor union is facing down the street that's in the public domain. To Congress and trying to get a certain candidate elected president. The Service Employees International Union, the largest healthcare union, put 4,000 volunteers into the field to help elect President Obama. They were successful. They also donated $35 million of their members' money to make sure that happened. Now that they have the field almost settled the way they want it, they're going to get a friendly NLRB. They have friends at the Department of Labor. They have a very, very good friend in the White House. They have friends in Congress, and they have a Democratic majority, and the NLRB is going to be stacked very shortly with friends who are favorable to unions. The only thing missing is the resolution of this congressional action. And once that's done, we think they're going back to work with all these new tools that they have. So message to the assembled multitude here is to use the time that we have now to get ready so that when they do show up, they don't find a worthy opponent and they go someplace else.
And, you know, quickly in summary, 10 lessons in light of that onslaught that Bill is referencing that we do anticipate, things that every company needs to be in a position to say they've completed. One, your wages and benefits have got to be competitive. You know, those continue to be one of the most important toeholds that a union has for credibility with respect to an organizing campaign. Secondly, personnel policies need to be fair and consistently enforced. They need to be up to date. They need to include a credible non-solicitation, non-distribution policy. They well should include a statement that the company does not support union organizing and believes that fair communication within our organization between management and employees is the effective way for ensuring fair employment and guaranteeing productivity. Three, management communication must be effective, and that it has to occur within all levels of management. It needs to come from the top, but it also needs to be effective at the first line supervisory level. If management occurs through intimidation and through games, obviously, and there isn't an ability of an employee to effectively raise a grievance and to effectively identify what's perceived to be unfairness, those are that's the environment in which a successful union campaign can fester. Fourth, employee attitude surveys and the 360 review process of supervisors is an effective way for gathering information, credible information, about what the sore spots are, if any, within your organization. You know, giving employees that opportunity to voice those concerns, you know, and then have them effectively evaluated and addressed. And you need to have that response issue as well. You know, that system, that which requires a significant amount of ongoing energy to it, but that system of communication is clearly one of the most effective ways to be able to defeat a union toehold in your group. Bill?
Just to follow up on the lessons learned, and we'll wrap this up pretty quickly. With respect to the 360 reviews, the surveys, identifying supervisors who could be problematic, I think, is critical, because a change is only as strong as its weakest link, and the people who are closest to the people who are going to be voting are your line supervisors. And a lot of times they're under significant pressure to meet demanding and competitive standards and production requirements. And sometimes when they're under pressure, employee relations isn't the first thing on their minds. Maybe they're alienated. Sometimes supervisors can be alienated from senior leadership, and in that instance, they're really not delivering a positive view of the company. Maybe it's in their body language. Maybe it's the things that they're saying, but that can create a vulnerability. And if they're not paying attention to the needs of their workers or the concerns of the people that they supervise, small grievances can fester, and that can lead to problems. That doesn't mean that employees have to get everything that they want, but if they have a concern or a complaint, management needs to listen and respond. And if the answer is no, the answer is no, but explain why. And that's why we think that focus groups and sessions that give employees an opportunity to communicate their concerns and for management to listen are a good idea, and that enhances management's ability to fix things if there is a campaign that goes on, if we still have time for a campaign. So education of supervisors, identifying and strengthening supervision, developing positive, effective leadership will instill a trust in management, and that, coupled with knowing the rules about what you can and can't do in an organizing campaign, will go a long way to reduce your vulnerability. I think that wraps up what we have to say today. We are available for questions. We've run a little bit over. We apologize for that. But we are going to be here after this session for as long as necessary to answer any questions that you might have. We would appreciate it if you would fill out the surveys that are included in your materials. They help us very much in determining, you know, what we can do better and what topics might be suitable for future seminars. So we really appreciate your attendance. I want to thank Bill very much for joining us here today. It's been a pleasure, and thank you.